yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, it looks like Wednesdays are becoming Black Wednesdays as far as economic news is concerned. We tend to have the bombshells every Wednesday, and boy, we had them this week, didn't we? Well, what happened? Two things that are standout. The one, of course, is the Fed, after 10 years, finally started reducing interest rates. It cut the federal funds rate, the benchmark rate that influences other interest rates, by 0.25%. Oh, big deal. Whoopee. Why only 0.25%? Well, the Fed isn't totally convinced that it should start a whole series of reductions of interest rates because the Fed doesn't have much to reduce. You know, interest rates now peaked, I'm talking about the federal funds benchmark rate, peaked at 2.375%. That's pretty low. You know, last year the Fed was desperately trying to get rates up because it knew the next recession is coming, so it would have some ammunition. But it only got it up to 2.375%, and it precipitated a crisis in the markets, the financial markets last fall, if you remember. I've talked about that before. And a firestorm of opposition to the Fed raising rates, not only by Trump, but by, you know, the investors sitting behind him. And it stopped raising rates. And now it's sort of complied with the pressure, increasing pressure over the last 6 months from Trump and others, to start lowering rates. So it lowered rates, but only 0.25%. Well, it's trying to save its ammunition. We'll get back to that shortly here, but that's one of the big events this past week. What are the consequences of that? What does it really represent? Will it have any effect? Will there be more rate cuts inevitably coming soon? You know, what are the results of that move? Okay, what's the second big development? Well, it is within hours of the Fed rate cut, Trump threw one of his trade tantrums here, and he raised tariffs on the remaining $300 billion of China imports to the U.S. You know, you'd already have 25% tariffs on $250 billion. And now it's another 10%, which he said is going to go to 25% pretty soon on the remaining $300 billion. And the remaining goods of this $300 billion, 10%, are really consumer goods. And if the past year on the first round of tariffs, the $250 billion, or any indicator, it's simply going to be passed on. And now, because they're mostly consumer goods, it'll be passed on to the U.S. consumer, i.e. inflation coming, import inflation on a lot of goods. Well, that's going to have a nice effect on consumer spending, consumption, which is the only thing holding up the U.S. economy right now, because second quarter GDP numbers, very clearly business investment is stagnating. It's in trouble across the board. Businesses are pulling back, freezing up investment. Investment's the big driver of the economy and the business cycle, you see. It eventually spills over. And we're seeing that investment slowdown already spilling over to investment in the housing sector, construction in general, commercial property construction, not just residential housing, you see. Both of those are contracting already. Is a 0.25% rate cut going to have any effect on housing? No. How about commercial property? No. So, we see investment slowing down already. And that's a harbinger of things to come. Not just in structures and housing and construction, but in manufacturing. The PMIs, as they call them, purchasing manager indexes, are one by one for region after region in the U.S. Beginning to slip to zero or below. Now, that's occurring everywhere, you see, globally. We are in already a global manufacturing recession worldwide. And that's very important because that contraction spills over eventually into the services sectors, and then you have a global recession and a U.S. recession similarly. But the U.S. is lagging behind all the others because the U.S. is exporting its economic problems to the rest of the world. And it can do that because it's the empire, you know, the core of the empire, controls the currency, controls, you know, a lot of other economic levers, and the action it takes, it can stave off its decline, but exacerbate in doing so the decline of other areas of the globe. Okay, so we have two big events that have occurred here. The Fed cutting rates for the first time, 0.25%, and Trump's trade tantrum, raising 10% more on China and pushing the trade tariff conflict with China into an economic war, from a tariff war to an economic war. We are on the cusp of that right now. And we'll talk about that more. What does an economic war look like as opposed to a tariff spat, which is what this has been up until now? You know, China's going to respond to this. How it responds is going to be interesting. We'll see very soon. They've signaled, you know, it's going to have a response. So far, China has done a tit-for-tat response. China does not import anywhere near as much from the U.S. as the U.S. does from China. Ah, but China, you know, its imports from the U.S. Have a big sectoral effect, i.e. the agricultural sector and small manufacturing and even the tech sector. It imports a lot. You know, soybeans, pork futures, all these agricultural commodities from the U.S., which happen to be in Trump's red state base. You know, and so far, Trump has mitigated the effect of China so far not buying soybeans and other commodities from the U.S. like it did. Trump has mitigated that by giving, what, $30 billion in subsidies now, direct subsidies to agribusiness, mostly U.S. agribusiness, because that's really what produces a lot of the commodities in the U.S. for export. Well, how much more? If the trade war goes on, which it is now, there's no settlement in 2019, possibly a settlement in 2020. Why possibly? Well, for that, I suggest listeners go read my blog on my blog, jackerasmus.com. I reposted an article that I wrote earlier in July, or maybe it was in June, because there was another one in July, two articles there on China and U.S. trade war, worth reading. And the one entitled China versus the U.S. from tariff war to economic war. And the other, an analysis of the Osaka meeting, you know, the G20 Osaka meeting here in the June with Trump and President Xi from China meeting. And comparison of that with the previous meeting between the two in December 2018 in Buenos Aires. Interesting to note the parallels and similarities. But the piece, which is the lead article on my blog, jackrasmus.com, really, you know, examines the consequences and the potential next directions in this so-called U.S.-China trade war on the verge of being an economic war. Yeah. Well, you know, I've always argued there's a two-track policy here, trade policy under Trump, a phony trade war with U.S. allies, but the real trade war with China. And, you know, behind all of the smoke about U.S.-China trade, quietly the U.S. Just concluded, it looks like, another softball deal with Japan. You know, I've talked about the softball trade deals with South Korea and with Mexico, Canada, and sort of pre-softball deal with the EU, letting them off the hook here, and now Japan. In other words, it's just token changes to the other trade relationships, but the real target has always been China, and as I said many times on this show, it's all about technology. It's a technology war, you see, between U.S. and China. Both countries are responsible for, you know, what, 80-90% of all the patents in the world on next technologies. You know, with maybe Japan and Germany way behind. It's a technology war, and it's about next-generation technologies, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, 5G. This is what it's all about. This is at the crux of this trade dispute, because those technologies are not only the basis of the industries of the future and therefore global trade, but it's also, you know, the fundamental core of military technologies of the future. And the U.S. is doing everything it can to stop or slow China and developing these competing next-generation technologies. This is what's really behind why there's no agreement, because China's already agreed to buy $5 trillion of farm stuff from the U.S. It's already agreed to allow the U.S. to have companies and banks that have 51% interest in their operations in China. The U.S. has been demanding that for a long time, right? Those two big issues have been resolved. It's been resolved a long time ago. But the real crux to the crisis here is technology. Always has been. And Trump isn't getting what he wants from that. And when the U.S. trade team, led by neocons, by the way, Lighthizer, Bolton, in the background, Navarro, hardliners, anti-China hardliners, representatives of the military-industrial Pentagon complex in the U.S. that don't want to deal with China on trade unless there's a capitulation on the technology issue, you see. You know, they're over there leading negotiations. Oh, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, who represents the banks who already got what they want, 51%, is at his elbow, Lighthizer's elbow, you know, and it looks like there's like a joint head of the negotiating team. But it's really neocons still driving it because they got Trump's ear, and Trump so far has agreed with them. So they went over there. Last week, you know, to Beijing one day, then they rushed over to Shanghai, you know, and then they concluded real quick, busted negotiations. Nothing happened. You know, the Chinese have Trump's number, his negotiating number, and they're not going to capitulate. So what does Trump do? Well, he throws up more tariffs, 10% more. He thinks he's going to intimidate China into an agreement. It's not going to happen. China's economy is slowing, but China has the ability to move quickly and to offset the export negative effect on its GDP by boosting government investment and other measures. They can do that. Whereas the U.S. is not going to boost government investment as its economy slows. So the U.S. is in a weaker position. Of course, on the other hand, the U.S. is the global empire here, has control of the currency and so forth. That gives it an advantage economically in other ways. So we're going to see what happens to this trade war and watch in the background the phony trade war continue. But what happens next is going to be interesting. Which brings us to the Fed announcement. The 25 basis points, they call it. You know, 0.25%, 25. They call those basis points a reduction by the Fed. Fed Chairman Powell had his press conference here on Wednesday as well. And he cited the reasons for his 25% reduction in the federal funds rate, the benchmark rate. You know, you reduce the benchmark rate, all the other rates follow, theoretically. Actually, mostly, but short-term rates follow. Long-term rates, long-term 30-year bond rates and so forth are really determined by broad economic forces. You see, the Fed has no influence over long-term rates. But in theory, you know, the argument is if it influences short-term rates, you know, up to two-year, five-year bonds and commercial paper and so forth, you know, bills and notes, as they call them, that movement down in short-term rates will eventually bring long-term rates down. Well, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, you got to keep in mind that the Fed does not have control over all interest rates. In fact, over time, recently, in decades, it has had less and less influence over the trajectory of global rates in general. Yes, short-term rates, it can influence. But influencing short-term rates doesn't necessarily mean you're influencing investment in the economy. Domestic industries, you know, that aren't multinational corporations may be more influenced by Fed action and movement in short-term rates. But, you know, what if I'm a global multinational corporation? Do I really care whether the Fed lowers interest rates by 0.25%? Do I really care about the cost of money when I can go anywhere in the world and borrow dollars if I want to borrow them? And dollar money markets around the world that might be cheaper, euro dollars, Asian dollars, whatever, you know. No, I'm not. I don't respond to Fed rate changes very much. You know, I don't even borrow the money from banks and so forth. I float my own corporate bonds, a commercial paper. I don't go borrow from banks if I'm a big corporation, multinational corporation, you know. And I'm, by the way, so flush with cash anyway because of tax cuts and other measures since 2008. You know, I can use my cash. I'm so flush with so much. You know, or I can go borrow if I want to borrow from banks in global money markets. I don't have to go borrow in the U.S. influenced by Fed rates. If I'm a small business, that's different. If I'm a small business selling only in the U.S. market, that's different. Or I'm a small construction company or a remodeling company or something. Yeah, the rates are going to affect me. Yeah, but what that really means is the Fed has less and less of a sector of the total economy that it can influence. So this 0.25% rate cut, very little effect. And you got to distinguish whether the effect of an interest rate cut is going to be on real markets, real goods investment, plant, equipment, structures, so forth, business expansion, production expansion, which may hire real workers, or whether the rate cut is going to influence financial asset markets, stocks and bonds, derivatives, currencies, foreign currencies, and so forth. That's a big difference. You see, you've got to distinguish between financial assets and real assets, real goods. What's the effect of rate cuts on either of those? Well, in the past, you know, the rate cuts and keeping rates at for 7-8 years at zero, virtually zero, has influenced borrowing and issuing a corporate bonds and commercial paper at very, very low rates, right? We've had a flood of corporate bond issues because of the very low rates. And most of that money has gone into buybacks and dividend payouts. As I said many times on the show, over $1 trillion a year. And last year, $1.3 trillion. This year, $1.5 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. A massive redistribution of income because of low rates. It's not that they're borrowing from the Fed and giving it to their shareholders. No, it's because the rates are so low from the Fed, chronically, and now going back down, that it's so cheap for corporations to issue bonds and commercial paper and then take the proceeds of those bond issues and redistribute that to shareholders and buybacks and dividend payouts. Or they use the money for mergers and acquisition activity, and that was buy up their competitors. You know, tech companies, big pharma companies, they're doing this a lot. That's where the low rates have stimulated financial asset markets, and mostly financial asset markets. Not very much anymore has gone into real expansion. Or if the companies are going to really expand, use their bond issues and, you know, the liquidity, the money they get from the bond issues, they've been expanding offshore with it, not in the U.S. So very low interest rates have stimulated financial asset markets since 2008, far more than they have stimulated real good investment in the U.S. Yeah. Or they're just hoarding it. They're just sitting on the money, you see. One or the other. You know, either into M&A, merger and acquisition activity, into financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, foreign exchange, derivatives of all kinds, right? Or offshore to expand multinational corporations' production offshore, or hoarding. Those four things. That's where the money's gone. That's what chronic low interest rates by the Fed have produced since 2008. Well, the Fed kind of took a different track and said, whoa, gee, you know, this has been going on so long. Hey, look, the banks were bailed out in 2010. You know, why did the Fed have to continue super low rates? Because the rest of the capitalist class said, hey, we like this golden goose. Don't kill it. And the Fed went on for years feeding, subsidizing, using monetary policy to subsidize investors. And, of course, we get this huge income inequality as a result, as they pay out trillions of dollars every year in buybacks and dividend payouts, trillions of dollars. You know, those who make their living from capital incomes, you know, capital gains, capital incomes, went through the roof. That's the big driver for income inequality. At the same time, wages are stagnating, you know. That's why we have so much inequality. It's on the financial side. It's not simply for not raising minimum wages, you see. That has relatively less effect than the boost to the upper end, the capital income end. Okay, so we have the press conference of Powell here. And what did he cite as a reason for now lowering interest rates by 0.25%? Well, he said, look, I'm concerned not about the U.S. economy. He said, the U.S. economy, you know, is not all that bad. Well, it is, but he says it's not all that bad. And he points to the fact that the global economy is slowing and global trade, latest figures, global trade, is flat. It's not growing at all. I think it was like 0.5%, the latest figures I've seen, of global trade and going south. So it's flat. And GDP, global GDP, is not much better, not much higher. And, of course, GDP is largely driven by China and the U.S., global GDP, and both are slowing now. So GDP will probably be flat. And then we see these recessions popping up in all the, you know, one emerging economy after another everywhere. And, of course, Europe is stagnating. We'll talk about that some more, because Germany's darn close to a recession. Italy is already stagnant or in recession. France, manufacturing all over Europe is in recession. All right. And now we're facing in the UK the hard Brexit in October, which looks like it's going to happen now. That's going to certainly be the coup de grace for Europe and push it by the end of the year into a recession, Europe-wide, UK-wide. Yes, and the U.S. economy will continue to slow, and China's economy will continue to slow. By year end here, we could be on the precipice of a global recession. Easily. And don't underestimate the negative impact of what's going on in the U.S. on the U.S. economy. As I said, construction is already in recession. Manufacturing is, you know, stagnant or will be in recession by year end. All we got is a service sector holding it up. But, you know, every recession always starts. Well, not every recession, but most traditional recessions start somewhere in either construction or manufacturing, and then it eventually spills over to the service sector. That's what happened, you know, in 2000, and recession then, 2001. It's what happened in other recessions in the U.S. 2008 was a different animal. 2008, the financial sector crashed and dragged down the rest of the economy in tandem. So the crisis began in finance and then spilled over to the real sector of the economy, construction, right? Then manufacturing, then services. I think the next recession around the corner will not be like 2008. It will not be the financial cycle dragging down the real cycle. It will be just the opposite. It'll be the real cycle, the real economy, which will then precipitate a financial crisis. You see, what is the relationship between financial cycles and real cycles? Most economists don't know, don't pay any attention to financial cycles. You know, their whole training has been in the national income product accounts, GDP accounts, and looking at those variables, which are real economic variables and not financial variables. Most mainstream economists know zit about the financial sector. That's why they can't forecast anything anymore accurately. Okay, so, you know, my study, like in Systemic Fragility in Global Economy 2016, is really about trying to understand what is the relationship between financial cycles and real cycles. How do they interact and drive each other? That's the important thing, how they interact, mutually depend, and determine each other. And in 2008, you know, periodically sometimes you get the financial sector driving it, and then you tend to get even deeper contractions like we did. That's happened before in 1907-8. You know, it was a financial crash dragged down the economy. And it tends to create a stagnation, a poor recovery for some time after that, or what I call an epic recession, you see. 1907 to 1913, that was an epic recession in the U.S. A financial crash followed by periodic short recoveries and slipping back into short recessions. Back and forth, back and forth. Well, we had two subsequent short recessions after 1907-8 crash. And it wasn't until you got a massive stimulus with World War I and big taxes on corporations for the first time and income taxes for the first time that you got a recovery. Well, 1929-31 was the same thing. You know, an epic recession, a financial crash that eventually spilled over into the rest of the real economy, and a sequence of banking crashes that occurred in 30, 31, 32, 33. In other words, financial after financial after financial crash, dragging the real economy down deeper and deeper. And it took a long time for it to come out of that. Well, 2008-9 was kind of like a financial crash that dragged down the economy. We've had it. We've had for the real economy, we've had a very poor recovery, you know, under Obama. Well, the next time is going to be different, though. Next time, this coming time, I think there is so much debt and zombie corporations out there now. Because of the Fed and the free money allowed them to borrow and stay afloat when they should have gone under a long time ago, a lot of these companies, zombies, you know, we call them junk bond finance companies or triple B investment grade finance companies, which are really junk bonds. Massive amount of junk, high yield junk, and triple B, which is really junk investment grade corporate bond issuance since 2008, kept these companies going. Well, the next time you get a contraction, which is coming, and if the banks don't continue to extend the junk loans to them, then what you're going to see is a lot of defaults, right? And it's not the junk bonds, leverage loans, which are kind of junk loans. You know, you got a high yield junk bonds, but you got high yield junk loans called leverage loans, over $1 trillion of that, over $1 trillion in the U.S. alone of junk bonds, you know, maybe more than $1 trillion of triple B bonds. You know, you got a lot of muni bonds that are poor quality as well. Well, the next recession, you know, when the real economy turns down, those companies are going to go under, and their defaults on those bonds are going to reverberate throughout the financial system and drag the financial system down. Or you could have the crisis, you know, beginning offshore. As I've talked about the problems with the European banks, big time. Right? And you can see a harbinger of the crisis is that so much of corporate bonds, I mean, government bonds are negative interest rates, you know? The central banks are at the end of their ropes, as I said in 2017 in that book. They're at the end of their ropes. You know, interest rate cuts aren't stimulating the real economy for various reasons anymore. And they've lowered rates so much in Europe and Japan in particular, right, that now these government bonds are negative. Negative interest rate, $14 trillion global of negative bond rates. Negative rates, $14 trillion. And rising fast in Europe, almost doubled within 1 year. And now the ECB, Central Bank, European Central Bank, is going to lower rates again here in September, maybe even before. Lower rates again is going to drive even more. 65% of corporate bonds are negative. I mean, government bonds are negative, and now corporate bonds are approaching negative as well. The ECB is going to have to buy more corporate bonds. That's going to drive more corporate bonds, as well as government bonds, into negative territory. Well, the same thing has been happening in Japan. And Japan has gotten even so desperate that its central bank, Bank of Japan, is not only buying, well, it bought up all the government bonds and not much left there, buying corporate bonds, but it's buying stocks. You see, the central banks have evolved in the 21st century into a role of subsidizing financial markets. That's their role. That's their mission. Right? Well, bailing out banks too, but after they bail them out, they keep subsidizing them with free money. Or buying up their securities to keep them from collapsing in price. If the Bank of Japan pulled out of doing that, you'd have a financial crash in Japan of epic proportions that would spill over the rest of the world. Well, Europe is now in the same situation as Japan. Sometimes it's referred to as the Japanization of the economy. And even here in the U.S., they're beginning to say, are we on the Japanization of the U.S. economy track? Is this similar? Well, in some ways it's similar. Because lowering interest rates and subsidizing the financial system the way the central banks are is a street of no return. You pump so much money into the financial system through low rates, and you can't get it back out. And your rates end up chronically stuck at the low bound, the zero bound, as they say. Well, look at the U.S. Rates peaked at 2 3/8 here last year. Not much ammunition for the Fed here to stimulate the real economy. It's been so busy subsidizing the financial markets for 10 years that it's got very little left in terms of rate policy to stimulate the real economy with. And that's why it reduced it only 0.25%, you know, at 2 3/8. You know, they don't want to shoot off all their ammunition. Not that they got much left. Yeah. So, rates 2 3/8 here peaked. What did they peak before the 2008 crash? 5 1/4. What did they peak before the 2001 recession? 6.5%, federal funds rate. 1990 recession, 8%. So the long-term trend is that in subsidizing the financial markets, the Fed has painted itself into a corner, and all the central banks have done the same. They're in a corner. Their rates are stuck so low, they can't use rate policy to stimulate the real economy. They've been so busy subsidizing the financial markets to the tune of trillions that now, you know, they not only don't have the ammo, their gun has jammed. They can't even shoot it if they had the ammo, to use a metaphor. Yeah, it's, you know, it's been planning. Look, central banks have been transforming from a mission of using rate policy to stabilize the real economy to using chronic low rates to subsidize the financial non-real economy. That's a fact. Well, that's also why the Fed and central banks have had to turn increasingly towards other means like quantitative easing, which is where they're not about lowering rates. They just pump money directly into the economy, bypassing the bond markets, by directly buying up bonds from private investors. Yeah, that's what they do. There'll be more QE. You know, the Fed announcement here, 0.25% reduction, was also accompanied by an announcement by Powell that they're going to stop selling off their Fed's balance sheet. In other words, you know, the $4 to $5 trillion they accumulated by buying up bad bonds since 2008, you know, they were trying to get rid of it, sell it off. Well, now they're stopping the sell-off 2 months early. You know, earlier in the year, he announced that they would stop in September. Well, now this past week, he said, well, we're going to stop August 1st. So they've stopped, you know, which is another way of lowering interest rates in the sense, because if they kept selling it off, that would be pushing rates up, all things equal. So now they've stopped that as well. Well, the Japanese never said they were going to stop QE. You know, they're buying tens of billions of dollar equivalent every month. And the European Central Bank had indicated it was going to start selling off, but as now indicates, it's not, and probably will increase QE going forward. And then if QE doesn't work, you know what they're going to do? If there's a crisis in the banking system, they're going to do bail-ins. Bail-ins mean, you know, depositors like you and I and your savings in the bank and so forth. If the bank's in trouble, if Wells Fargo goes under, right, they're going to take your deposits and they're going to exchange it for the worthless bank stock at the time. So you're going to end up with bank stock instead of dollars. That's bail-ins. It's already been tried in Europe. They already have plans on the book in the U.S. and U.K. to do just that, the next banking crisis. Okay, so we got Powell saying You know, the big problem here is threefold. One, we got a slowing global economy everywhere. We have slowing trade. We see the recessions beginning to appear here and there, like red flags throughout the global economy. Right? And the trade wars, according to Powell, are having an effect. On what? On business investment and uncertainty. You see, business does not invest if it thinks the future is uncertain. And that's really clear in the second quarter GDP, business investment contracting. Well, not contracting, but slowing dramatically because of uncertainty, mostly around the trade war and the global economy. And other things are beginning to emerge, you know, like you, I don't know if you read and heard about it, but, you know, Japan and South Korea are feuding. Well, that feud and that tit-for-tat actions are taken against each other is a secondary consequence of the U.S.-China trade war. So business investment uncertainty due to trade was another reason why Powell announced his cut. Also, he said that he's a little concerned the fact that inflation in the U.S. in real goods and services was slowing down, or what's called the PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, at about 1.5%. You know, it should be at 2, but now it's 1.5%. Well, that's an indicator of the slowing real economy going on, right? So, trade wars, slowing global economy, concern about inflation, or disinflation as it's called, these were behind Fred's press conference, Powell's press conference here. Well, what was the reaction? Well, you would think, well, he's reduced the cost of money. That's, you know, going to be a boost to stocks. No, just the opposite. Big sell-off in stocks. Investors say, hey, this is not enough. They were kind of expecting a half. Well, if the Fed shot a half, you know, percent, and nothing happened, which it wouldn't, except maybe boosting stock market for a couple of weeks, nothing happened, well, then it would set in, the realization would set in that the Fed can't influence, that even with half a cut, it can't influence things anymore. Well, then Trump piled on and said, oh, you know, that's not enough, Powell, and he's attacking him again, right? And then Trump quickly raised the tariffs, another 10%. Well, that was a double whammy for the stock markets, you see. It really gave the signal, whoa, this trade war is getting worse, not better. Oh, business investment uncertainty is going to get worse, not better. And it's pretty clear that earnings have peaked now. They're talking about an earnings recession, corporate earnings recession. So all of that has converged, you know, inadequate Fed rate cut, Trump tariffs, trade war getting worse, uncertainty getting worse, and the stock market contracted and still contracting. Still. And the money's flowing out of stocks into safe havens, like treasuries. And the demand for treasuries is rising, and the price of treasuries, not the interest rate, are rising. And, you know, safe havens like gold and so forth, right? The 0.25% will not have any effect. Is not have any effect. Either on real investment and the real economy, nor now on the financial economy. In other words, Fed monetary policy is dead in the water. It's at the end of its rope, as I've said. You know, and in Europe and Japan, it's not even the end of the rope. It's the thread from the end of the rope that they're holding on to. Long term, it's been clear that there's been a shift from the impact, the impact that rate cuts have long term as the economy has become financialized. You know, rate cuts, a lot of the rate cut effect goes into financial markets. But now the bubble is so high in financial markets that it has little effect there as well. And in general, it has little effect. Rate cuts have little effect as you get near to what's called the zero bound, near zero interest rates. You know, cutting rates further has no stimulus effect. And the U.S. is getting dangerously close to zero rates. And of course, the other big economies, Europe and Japan, are already in zero rates. And cutting them further, as the central banks will not do anything. But if those countries refuse to stimulate the economy with government spending, you know, they put all the pressure on the central bank to do something and make it look like they're doing something. But that only puts off the day of reckoning. What drives the stock markets today is not a 0.25% rate cut of the Fed. It's these massive buybacks of $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion every year. It's corporations buying their own stock that keeps that's been keeping the stock market up, right? Mostly large multinationals. And when they do that, of course, institutional investors like shadow banks, hedge funds, and so forth, they use algorithmic trading to buy stocks too. So when the buybacks, dividend payouts drive up the stock, then the institutionals and algo trading jump in, drive it a little bit more. And then retail investors, you know, who constitute only 15% of all the stock buying now, their passive investing, their index investing follows it. So that's what's keeping the stock market up. It's the buybacks, institutional, algo trading, passive investing. 0.25% has no effect anymore. And of course, it has no effect on real investment either. Why? Why does 0.25% have no effect on real investment? Well, because the uncertainty is far outweighing a minuscule 0.25% or 0.5%. Wouldn't have any effect. The uncertainty about the future of investment driven by the trade wars, okay, driven by the hard Brexit in Europe that's coming when Europe's stagnating, driven by the Japan-South Korea dispute, driven by global oil prices now and commodity prices collapsing once again, driven by the expectation that this whole cycle after 10 years is very long in the tooth, it's not going anywhere, and this big boost that it got last year from the Trump tax cuts, which went to investors and corporations, you know, that's dissipated now. There's no source for real stimulus to financial markets. And investors realize this, and they're going to start to move to the sidelines. Right? The Trump tax cuts are now dissipated after a year, supposedly. Right? And, you know, a good indicator of the lack of any real effect on these tax cuts is when you look at what's happening. I mean, the interest rate cuts, when you look at what's happening, construction, housing, residential construction, both existing homes and new homes on residential side are continuing to slow down and contract. They're actually contracting. Has there been any move with 0.25% rise? No. Look, investment is not driven by the cost of money. That's only one factor that investors keep in mind when they invest. It's driven by the expectations of future profitability, not the cost of the investment, but the profitability of it. And if you got a slowing global economy and all the other economic indicators are negative or uncertain, that's far going to overweigh a 0.25% cut in the cost of money. Far. What we have is both fiscal and monetary policy, and this is very important. Listen, Fiscal and monetary policy used to be tools to stabilize the real economy. Since the financialization of the economy, since neoliberal policies, since especially 2000, what we got now, and especially since 2008, is both fiscal and monetary policy are subsidizing capital incomes. They are tools that are being used now to subsidize capital incomes. They are not tools to stabilize the economy. Whether stabilization means, you know, stimulate it to come out of a recession or prevent it from getting overheated in terms of inflation. No, it has nothing, and that's what mainstream economists still teach. It less and less has anything to do with that. It's all about subsidizing capital incomes massively. You know, the monetary policy and the Fed since 2008 did that to $1 trillion every year for 7 years. And then when that had reached its max and the Fed had no ammunition and started raising rates, then the policymakers, the capitalists, switched to, well, let's use tax policy to subsidize. Let's let the Fed raise some rates here, and we'll offset that with even greater tax cuts for investors. And that's what happened for 2 years. But now that's producing $1 trillion a year annual deficits and national debt. And the CBO recently said it could be $1.7 trillion in the future, a year. And that the interest on the debt alone, national debt, is going to be $900 billion a year by 2027. Right. So the fiscal policy is dead in the water. Tax cuts. You know, they've given so much to investors and corporations, there's nothing left that they can use or afford to use because the deficit is debt to stimulate the real economy. Just as interest rates are so damn low and they've subsidized for so long and they have no effect, there's nothing they can do to lower rates to stimulate the real economy. This is the big contradiction of capitalism as we entered the third decade of this century. Okay, let's turn to the trade war. What's going to happen here? What are going to be the responses? What could be the responses by China? Well, they're going to respond, you see, because China's got Trump's number now, and they're not going to fall for it. You know, he sandbagged them twice. He got them to make concessions in May of 2018, and then the neocons blew up the negotiations. You know, Mnuchin came back from Beijing, said he had a deal. And the neocons got their friends, the military industrial complex and Congress, to squash it. And that blew up. And then after Buenos Aires, you know, Trump convinced Xi, okay, let's really negotiate here. And the Chinese did that, made more concessions. And then right before they were coming over in May of this year, the neocons blew it up again by demanding, you know, unacceptable terms from China. What did they do? Well, they said, hey, China, you know, we're going to keep the tariffs anyway, even we have a deal. Or, hey, China, you know, we're going to continue going after Huawei and your other companies, not only here in the U.S., but globally. And, oh, by the way, China, you know, you got to share your next generation technology findings with us. And stop subsidizing your state-owned enterprises because we don't do that to ours. So the Chinese came over and they said, is this for real? Donald, is this for real? And it was. And they went home and nothing happened, you know, until Osaka, G20. And Trump tried to play the same game that he played in Buenos Aires with China. And China didn't bite. You know, and then he sent last week his trade team over to Shanghai, and China said, well, show me the money, you know, talk, show me to come off these onerous demands or there's no deal. And they didn't come off it, and Trump thinks that he's going to intimidate them with more tariffs. Well, this is going to evoke responses from China, and what could those responses be? One, they're going to let their currency, the yuan, devalue. They don't have to manipulate, enter the markets to drive their currency down. And they're going to let the U.S. and global forces devalue it instead of intervening as they had to stop it from devaluing. They'll just stop intervening. And you're going to see the exchange rate to the dollar go above 7. That's going to set up a global currency war, by the way, which we're on the cusp of already. What else can they do? They can slow buying of U.S. treasuries, you know, the $1.3 trillion they have. They can just slow down purchasing that, which they've already done. They can stop purchasing, next step. And if it gets worse, they can start selling off. They can squeeze the U.S. and the rest of the economy by their control of what's called rare earth minerals. They could launch a nationalist movement to buy China and not buy American products or buy German products, Chinese consumers, but not American. They could follow with tariffs of their own. They could follow with other non-tariff barriers to make it uncomfortable for U.S. corporations doing business. Of course, not implement the 51% concession they made, and not start buying soybeans and other farm products that Trump needs to happen before the election. They can intervene and make sure that there's no deal in Korea, North Korea. They have a lot of options, and they're going to start using them if the U.S. continues pushing hardline, as Trump will. You know, look, Trump's plan B is that as the U.S. economy slows, you know, I can always blame China for it, right? He may do that, or he may simply get so much pressure from the farm sector and other sectors that he will agree next year and take what's on the table and plan to come back and fight over the tech issue after the election. That could happen too, and I mentioned that in my two articles. Again, to close, I would simply say go and check out the two articles on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Okay, that's it for today. This is Alternative Visions, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to say on these topics next week. Streets are screaming now.